This is how the lungs of the planet sound at night. This is the Amazon. It's the world's biggest rainforest. It sprawls over more than 2 million square miles, about the size of the United States, not counting Hawaii and Alaska. Most of the Amazon is in Brazil. And you know that part about it being the lungs of the planet? It actually does produce about 20% of the planet's oxygen. And then there's the Amazon River, which deserves some superlatives of its own. It's the world's biggest by volume, and it runs neck and neck with the Nile as being the longest. It has more than 1,000 tributaries and a rich diversity of species, as does the rainforest that surrounds it. Of the 10 million or so species of animals, birds, and insects known to man, more than half live in the Amazon rainforest. I traveled here to the Amazon with an old friend to look at the impact and potential impacts of efforts to develop this region, to build dams and expand agribusiness. Versions of this have been going on for decades, but now with new players, notably China. Chinese companies are coming in to invest in new dam projects, to operate some dams, to export soy and beef and other commodities. In fact, China's State Power Investment Corporation won in an auction in late September 2017 the right to operate the Cao Simao hydropower dam. It paid more than $2 billion, despite concerns in Brazil about privatizing the operations of Brazil's dams. China's Three Gorges Corporation owns a third of the Cao Manuel dam. And a third Chinese company, the Zhejiang Electric Power Construction Company, has expressed interest in buying a share of the huge Belo Monte dam. That dam is already operating, though still under construction. When finished, it will have the world's third largest capacity. And even before China got interested in Brazil, development had put at risk the role the Amazon has long played in helping keep the global environment in balance. Brazil actually has huge potential for solar and wind energy, but it still gets most of its energy from hydropower. In fact, it's the second largest user of hydropower in the world, after China. And when Brazil's government made its five-year plans in early 2016, it didn't really even consider solar or wind. Hydropower got the focus. Over time, developers in Brazil have proposed building more than 400 dams in the Amazon basin, and more than a quarter of them are either completed or already under construction. That and other development has led to the clearing or flooding of thousands of square miles of rainforest. In the past four decades, 20% of Amazon rainforest has been cleared, more than in over four centuries of colonization. And that has had a profound impact on Brazil's environment, with knock-on effects that affect climate change and the world.
But, I mean, the environment is the base of everything. For me, it's the base of everything is the environment. On top of that, what's happening to the environment explains what can happen to the economy. And then on top of the economy, what happens with the economy explains what happens in politics.
This is that old friend I mentioned, John Watts, a longtime international correspondent with The Guardian newspaper in Britain, now its new environment editor. We traveled together just before John left Brazil, where he had served for 5 years as The Guardian's Latin America correspondent. We stopped at one point to have a beer in Santarém and look out at the dramatic sight of the muddy brown Amazon River meeting the sparkly blue Tapajós River. We could see a huge expanse of water with a clean line down the middle, half blue, half brown. We talked not just about our journey in the Amazon, but about John's journey as a journalist. For you, this has been a very long journey because you were in China for 9 years and you covered China and then you covered the environment and then you've been in Brazil for 5 years where you've also been covering the environment but also Brazil in general and its development and its challenges and problems with development. So as you're sitting here looking at the sunset over these two rivers, what are you thinking about?
Wow. Well, we're in Santarém and this is your first visit to Brazil and your first visit to the Amazon, and I'm thinking, actually, this was my first visit to Brazil and my first visit to the Amazon. I also came to Santarém. This was 11 years ago, and I was here to look at a story of the soy frontier being pushed even into the Amazon in order to meet the growing Chinese demand for food. So in one sense, I'm thinking, nothing's changed. The story has just kept going and going and going and getting bigger and bigger. And now it's reached a stage where we're seeing plans to massively expand this town, to build a big port, to build hydroelectric dams further upstream, railways, and it's as if things have moved forward absolutely against what every environmentalist wanted, but have moved forward in a way that has proved that the economy seems to win almost every time.
Indeed, the mayor of Santarém told John that he's hoping this city of 300,000 people will double in size and population within the next decade, powered in part by the more than 40 dams that are planned to be built on the Tapajós River and its tributaries. Those dams will help expand agribusiness, gold mining, cattle ranching, and more. They will help Brazil export soy from its heartland in Mato Grosso, the most productive soy-growing area in the world, to China, which buys more of it than anyone else. The dams and related development plans could mean the clearing of, by one estimate, almost 1 million hectares of rainforest. That's about 12 times the size of New York City. And that could release huge amounts of carbon dioxide and speed climate change. At a time when Brazil's economy is hurting, big projects that bring in money and grow the economy sound pretty good. But what will all this mean for the Amazon and for the planet? What will it mean for each of us and for those who come after us in this century and beyond? This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And I don't know about you, but the Amazon has loomed large in my imagination for as long as I can remember. This image of it, lush, vast, primordial, teeming with life. It's one thing to imagine it, it's another to be smack in the midst of it. It's astounding. On one early morning, John and I waded into the Tapajós River, the blue sparkly one that meets the Amazon in Santarém. We were deeper into the Amazon, in a smaller town called Itaituba, and we were climbing into a small, no-frills boat with an outboard motor to travel up the Tapajós to where one of those dams, the São Luís, is meant to be built. It was cold and rainy, and the wind whipped our faces. John was up in the front of the boat. He put a tarp in front of him to block the wind. I used my umbrella, kind of as a shield, across my torso. It actually worked pretty well. Along with us was a young Brazilian sociologist and activist for the rights of indigenous people, Fernanda Moreira. She was good-natured and unflappable. She's made this trip many times before. After a couple of hours, when we got to a wide expanse of water, she had the boat slow down.
The dam wall, like, it would be further right.
Absolutely. I mean, we can't see a single building, we can't see another boat, and yet they would move tens of thousands of people here. They want ships to come up here. Wow.
What's the likelihood that the dam's going to go ahead?
Oh, it's not. Because the license is canceled.
License is now canceled.
Yeah.
So what are the chances that it will happen anyway?
Well, we don't know, because Chinese government wants to invest here. Three guards want to construct. We don't know what they are planning. But the thing is, it was considered by the environmental organ, IBAMA. It was considered
viable.
Why?
Well, because of the environmental and social impacts here. But one main point was that there is an indigenous area that would be flooded, and you cannot remove the indigenous people from there. It's prohibited by the Brazilian constitution.
But she says that doesn't mean it's over, because there's money to be made in the dam that's planned across this pristine stretch of the Tapajós and all the development that will come with it. All told, the more than 40 dams that are planned for the Tapajós and its tributaries would increase Brazil's current supply of electricity by 25%. It would also provide incentives for more clearing of forests, more farming, more cattle ranching, more mining. Lots of money could be made here. Lots more rainforest could disappear. And some indigenous villages would, too. Fernanda has been working with the Munduruku, about 14,000 indigenous people who live in these parts. If the dam goes ahead, some of their villages would be submerged, others overrun by development. We're traveling to one of those villages to see what the villagers have to say about the dams. Not far after that place where we stopped, we reach what the Munduruku people call the waterfalls. Really, it's a flat expanse of rapids. Not much white water, but instead swirling big dips. Our boatman has navigated here before, but that didn't stop us from having a few jolts of white-knuckled fear as the boat dipped and dived. At one point, it tipped precariously and was within a couple of inches of taking in water. I had one of those moments of calmly thinking of what I'd do if we capsized, how to get to shore, what to do then, since my cell phone would be waterlogged or lost. We were out in the middle of nowhere. I was also unclear about whether the river had piranhas or crocodiles. Fernanda assured me later that the crocodiles tend to sleep during the day, and the piranhas don't really like the rapids. No wonder these rapids have served as a buffer over time. Besides being a buffer, this is a sacred place to the Munduruku. They believe the spirits of their ancestors live here. But if the dam comes, the rapids will disappear. On the other side of the rapids, the water calms down. And we slow down, too, because Fernanda sees a boatload of Munduruku villagers she knows. She offers to give some a ride home on our boat.
Falala, okay. We became a bus. That's great.
And in just a few minutes, we're at their village. It's called Dase Watpu, and on this rainy morning, villagers are crowded into a small wooden meeting hut with wooden benches lining the walls and a couple of women sitting on the floor making a drink from locally picked reddish-purple asahi berries in a huge metal bowl. They're celebrating the five-year anniversary of the local school. And this is a big enough deal that people have come from a neighboring Munduruku village, including that village's chief, Juarez Saw Munduruku. John and Fernanda and I sit down with him to talk about what the proposed dam would mean for these people. Juarez talks about the loss of species, of animals and birds and fish. He talks about the villages that will be flooded, not his, actually, because it sits higher on a hill, but this one, where we're gathered, it would go. He says, the Munduruku people are actively resisting, because this is our land. And since the government hasn't demarcated it as such, the Munduruku people have. They've put up signs on the edges of the 170,000 hectares they claim, or about twice the area of New York City. The government has yet to recognize that self-demarcation. Fernanda is translating all this. John speaks decent Portuguese, too, but he figures Fernanda will get some nuances he might not.
Did they offer you any compensation, or did they offer to move people, and is that a possibility?
Para nós, pessoalmente, ninguém falou assim.
He's saying that Munduruku people is not negotiating with the government. Nobody from the government came here to talk to them, offer compensations or something like that. But even if they did, they won't accept anything. The only thing that they want, and they are fighting for that, is the demarcation of their land.
Have you ever had to fight? I mean, literally fight? Are you willing to? Do you think? Yeah, I mean, I suppose they're fighting in the way they fight, by demarcating the land, right? Yeah, yeah, that is their fight.
Eu não sei, porque nós, como liderança...
He said that they are against all the projects that come with the dams, especially mining, because mining would let the soil sick. And this is how they survive. So the forest gives everything for them. They don't need to pay anything. If you go to the city, everything you will eat, you have to pay. So the forest gives everything for them. So they are the protectors, the guardians of the forest.
Has anyone from this village gone to live in a city?
Mas as pessoas, assim, os Munduruku.
There are some of them that live in the city, but they are not well. Munduruku that go to the city is always being exploited. They don't have a job or they have bad jobs. They go to clean houses and things like that. And so if they could, like, come to the village, the way of life they have here is better than in the city. That's his perception.
By this point, we've all been sitting around for some time, slapping biting black flies. John and I will each have bite marks for days, radiating out in bright red circles. They're very impressive. So, okay, one man's paradise might not be another's, but that's not the point. For the Munduruku, this place is fundamentally part of who they are. On the other side of the argument are people like Roberto Jawaribe, the president of the Brazilian Export and Investment Promotion Agency and a former Brazilian ambassador to China. John and I met with him in Rio de Janeiro before we set out for the Amazon.
At this point, I think all of Brazil is very much geared towards the idea that we have to increase our trade. We have to be more open in relation to new possibilities. And I think there's a general consensus in this direction, which was not really present in the past. And of course, I have the task of being a promoter of both trade and investment. And today, trade, investment in both directions are totally associated. You cannot think of one without the other.
What proportion of Brazil's exports at the moment are commodities? And how would you like to see that change?
Well, there is a lot of misinformation in relation to this, because commodities are no longer really commodities. I mean, in order to be competitive as an agricultural producer, the secret of Brazil has been research and investment in research and in new modalities. And this has probably been the most important reason why we have opened the vastest new agricultural frontier in the world, which is the Midwest of Brazil, the savannas of Brazil, where most of the advances in grain cultivation and other things have developed over the past 40 years. You know, you have to recall the fact, which many people don't even think it's possible, that about 40, 50 years ago, Brazil was a net food importer. And this revolution is really due to research. And actually, agricultural research is by far the area where Brazil has developed more strengths for over 100 years, actually, much more than in other types of research. We are the most competitive producer of many of the most relevant producers of the world. And we are, without any doubt, the country that has the most capability of expanding significantly our agricultural production. And I must add this, which is fundamental and which is subject to very significant distortions, without affecting at all natural vegetation cover. Brazil's native vegetation is still around more than 60%, maybe as high as 65% of our territory. The number in Europe is 0.3%. Still, we are accused of deforestation to increase our agricultural capacity, which is obviously to the benefit of some other agricultural producers, but not to the benefit of facts and reality. There has been obvious devastation in Brazil, but it has essentially been dealt with over the past decades. And the original purpose of devastation of the 60s and the 70s was really strategic of occupation of areas of low demography and perceived as strategically sensitive. Of course, they generated some agriculture, some cattle cultivation, of course, but this is not the reason for the expansion of the production in Brazil. So this is an area which we cannot but pay a lot of attention to, because the FAO expects a rise in demand of food consumption of about 30% over the next, I don't know, 20 years or something of that nature. And to be able to cope with this additional demand, Brazilian production would have to rise by more than the double of that average, because we are the country that has the most capability of doing so.
João Uribe sees a promising and profitable agribusiness future for Brazil, one that will benefit not just the 200 million-plus Brazilians, but also many more people on Earth. He sees Brazil's empty, undeveloped land as an opportunity. Of course, the Munduruku don't see it like that. To them, the land is not empty. It is full of life, and it supports their way of life. And in Brazil, the rights of indigenous people actually have some weight. They have been able on occasion to slow or stop dam building and development in their territory. Of course, there are also the other times when loggers or miners or others who want to make money by clearing land get indigenous people out of the way by whatever means necessary. Murders are not uncommon. But officially and legally, the concerns of indigenous people are meant to be taken seriously in Brazil. John and I remarked to each other how different it is in China, where we were both correspondents for years. In China, if the government wants to build a dam, it will move whoever needs to be moved to get it done. For the Three Gorges Dam on the Yangtze River, it moved between 1 and 2 million people. Millions more have been moved around the country over time for other dam projects. China's Communist Party leaders argue that by doing this, they're saving millions more lives from flooding and creating power to fuel China's growing economy. But at what cost to nature? Chinese geologists have warned that some dams near fault lines may even contribute to more deadly earthquakes, perhaps even the one a decade ago in Sichuan that killed 88,000 people. Here in this village, John has a China-related question for village chief Juarez.
The Chinese companies are investing or want to invest in this project. What would you say to them, if you could speak to them directly?
Quando ele conseguir fazer, ele vai chegar a dizer com o governo, ajudar o governo brasileiro também, dizer que construiu a barragem aqui, para dizer que é uma energia limpa, não é energia limpa.
Juarez speaks for a while, and as he speaks, Fernanda tears up. When it comes time for her to translate, she turns to John.
Sorry, can I ask you to translate this?
What he said was, you know, if you could speak to them, I'd like you to say to them, you know, don't help the Brazilian government to build this, because although they're saying it's clean energy, it's not clean energy, it's very dirty, it's mixed with blood, and it makes me very sad when I hear what they're doing.
Yes, it's, the government will have to kill them to do any of those projects.
Outside, village kids are playing, swinging from wooden parallel bars, climbing on boats. They seem pretty carefree. I wonder whether their kids will feel the same way, whether they too will be playing in this traditional Munduruku land, or whether they will, in the end, be either pulled or pushed into cities by all the development that may yet come here. The Amazon rainforest is already 20% cleared. What happens if this continues? What's already happening here? I asked Juarez, who's 56 years old, what kind of changes he's seen in his own lifetime in the weather and in the climate here.
A mudança aí, durante esses anos para cá, ela vem mudando.
He said that, well, the white man is destructing nature, so the world will be on fire soon. They know it because they see that the sun is not the same, it's getting hotter and hotter. When he was little, he was a child, and he could work for a while, and now the sun is getting stronger, so the hours have to be shortened for their work, so it's changing a lot their lives as well. But he said this is because of the destruction of the nature.
There are few places on Earth now that don't feel some effect of climate change. But it makes sense that those living close to nature would feel it more. John, having lived and reported in China, thinks the pattern of development started by the West, embraced by China, and also adopted in Brazil, comes with a steep cost to the quality of life and to life in general. He made this comment after our trip to the Munduruku village.
Development in its current form is totally reducing diversity in the world. More concrete, more cement, less color, less biodiversity, and fewer varieties of culture and ways of life. You really are just making everybody sort of part of the same market, the same system. And, you know, I guess the Amazon in that regard is similar to Tibet or Xinjiang or Inner Mongolia. And let's make it all part of the same system and kind of even out the edges. And I suppose you could say that makes it a more economically efficient place, but a lot less colorful, a lot less diversity.
Back on dry land, and on the other side of another harrowing ride over the Tapajós Rapids, we contact the local government, and they send us to Itaituba's Municipal Environment Secretary, Bruno Rolim. He turns out to be no big fan of unbridled development.
Como é que eu posso dizer ele? O engarrafamento que ficou.
Wow, okay, so this is amazing. So he's talking about the current situation. He said, look, our town, Itaituba, is in a very important strategic position for the transport of grain, mostly soy and corn from Mato Grosso. The ports and most of the business have emerged since 2010. There's six companies in Itaituba. Essentially what they do is they take out soy and corn, and they bring in fertilizer. He said our municipality gains almost nothing, but gets a lot of problems. We don't get a single cent in taxes from the ports that have been built, but they, you know, are sending all this stuff through to the United States and Europe and China, but we just get problems. In particular problem he mentioned was the roads, that all these lorries are currently coming up from Mato Grosso to Itaituba, and the traffic is incredible. Because there's more traffic, there's more accidents, there's more deaths, there's incredible traffic jams. He said the worst traffic jams are 50 kilometers long, and they lasted a week, and it was going on for so long that the drivers were hungry and thirsty, food was not getting through to the local towns, food supplies, ambulances couldn't get through. He said basically it was chaos. And I said, well, when was the last time this happened? He said, oh, 15 days ago. So
it's like the coal trucks in northern China.
It's just like the coal trucks in northern China. Very, very similar, where you've just got, you know, one commodity that's hugely in demand on a narrow bottleneck road, and chaos ensues when there's even a small hitch.
While John translates for me, Bruno pulls out his computer and shows us a video taken by a friend of his in a helicopter flying over that 30-mile, week-long traffic jam. It goes on and on and on, this long line of trucks on a dirt road in the rainforest. Bruno says that there are plans to widen this road and pave it. That may help ease the traffic jams, but it would also help more loggers and miners and ranchers and farmers who see profits to be made here. One of the planned developments for this region is to build not just a dam, but also a sort of a water highway, so boats and barges can carry grain. John asks, would that make things easier?
Itaituba, você concorda com a hidrovia ou é contra? Agora.
Se a gente concorda com a hidrovia, é contra? A gente concorda desde que ele seja bem planejado.
He just started with the maths. He said, you know, a single barge can carry much more than a truck. So if you just think of the economics, it would be better. He said, and that's the way they think, the companies think. He said, but I have a different view. It's true that the pollution from one barge is roughly equivalent to more than 10 trucks. So from that point of view, it's better to have a hydrovia than a road. But he said, but then you have to consider that on the river, you are affecting the water quality. And this poses greater risks because if you have an accident on the road, the spill is contained. Can't go very far. If you have an accident in the river, and especially when you're talking about things like fertilizer, and it would also be used to bring oil back and forward that's currently on the roads, then there's a big risk that this could affect a far, far greater area and more people. So I said, well, in that case, does the municipality support or are you against or for the hidrovia? And he said, we would only approve of it if it's done right, if it's well planned, if there is a strategy put in place to reduce the risk of accidents, so higher safety standards on the boats, and if there is a mechanism in place to deal with accidents rapidly when they happen. And then if there are actual benefits to our community, because at the moment he said everything is just for the big capitalists, the capitalists, Brazilian capitalists in Mato Grosso, and the overseas big capitalists who are trading and making money from the current situation. He said we'll only support this if it is of benefit to local people.
Bruno says he and others in the local government are worried about what a big infusion of Chinese investment might do here. They know that China has long put economic development ahead of environmental protection, and they fear that Chinese investors would do that here too. They also know that China hasn't signed important international treaties on labor rights. And Bruno says there was a group of four or five Chinese who came here to Itaituba not long before we met him. He says they wore black suits with little pins of the flags of Brazil and China on their suit sleeves. What will happen next, he has no idea. But it's not just China. The U.S. company Cargill is active here. So are European companies. So I'm wondering, with Brazil's once high-flying economy now just beginning to crawl back from a three-year recession, how tempting must it be for government officials to sacrifice the environment for economic gain, as China has done for so long? I'm wondering something else, too, based on what I saw in China, where the Ministry of Environment has little power.
How is it feeling to you being in this job in terms of the extent to which you have any clout as an environmental officer? I mean, like, how much is the government actually listening to the environmental agency?
Realmente, você falou um ponto interessante, né, que sempre a política ela interfere em todos os setores.
So, he says a very interesting question. Of course, politics interferes with all sectors of government, and that includes the environment. There is a movement to try to liberalize, I guess that means relax the rules, so that more businesses can generate more economic growth. But we continue to regulate, and it was a word I think it means like conscientiate, make people conscious of issues and problems. We try to bring problems within the law and deal with them within the law. Thanks to God at the moment, we do have little influence. We are helped by the fact that we get support from the public prosecutors and the police. When we bring a violation to their notice, the authorities can act. So we have the potential to resolve many, if not all, of the problems that are brought to our attention or that we are aware of. One of the things they try to do is to bring economic sectors into a legal framework. You've got the garimpeiros, the illegal miners, you've got the farmers who are doing things illegally. If we can bring them inside a legal framework, and cover their activities, we can mitigate the impacts rather than just leaving them outside. And finally says, I believe this office has enormous potential.
So that's different from in China. Even at the national level in Brazil, a committed environmentalist in the right place at the right time can make a difference in what happens in the Amazon. When I was back in Rio de Janeiro, I talked with former Environment Minister Isabela Teixeira. She, too, pulled out her computer and showed me a new monitoring system made possible by satellites that allows the Brazilian government to monitor 4 million parcels of rural property in and near the Amazon to make sure no one's clearing more rainforest than they've been given the right to clear. Before this system was in place, she says, people could say one thing and do another, and it would be hard for the government to check. That's how 20% of the Amazon rainforest disappeared in the past 40 years.
And looking to the future and look what you want to do, I think that is very important to consider three or four key challenges for Brazil. The first one, Brazil is an important country for biodiversity, and we have an important system of protected areas in Brazil, public areas. We have around 113 million of hectares under protection of federal government.
That's almost twice the size of Texas.
And everybody likes to talk, oh, the private sector or the private farmers, they were responsible for destruction for biodiversity in Brazil the last years, the high pressure that we have in Amazonia, what's happened with Amazonia deforestation, etc., etc., etc. But what was not clear the last years is that what indeed really happened there.
Now it's clearer, including the fact that deforestation for a time went down, but then started coming back up. The good thing is there's been less pressure over the past 3 years to build dams super quickly since the economy has been in recession, so Brazil hasn't needed as much extra power. But that could start to change now that the economy's recovering. And then, Isabella Teixeira says, there's another long-term challenge.
And we need also to put together environment protection with sustainable production. We need to conciliate development agenda. We are developing countries, and I don't know how we can promote the reduction of social inequalities in Brazil, for example, without accelerating our development.
But what does development mean, she asks? What should it mean to Brazil?
In the case of Brazil, you must understand that agriculture plays an important role, not only for development, but also for economic growth. Okay? And Brazil is an important producer of food. For food security in the next 20, 30 years, Brazil will be playing an important strategic role to food production in the world.
Back in Itaituba, John and I were guessing, based on our China experience, that local business people would be chafing at any restrictions on unfettered development. We were wrong, at least when it came to the president of the Business Association for Itaituba, Fabricio Priente Schuber. He runs a ceramic brick factory for housing construction.
We have spoken to many people here in Itaituba. So far, almost everybody is against the projects, is against the dam, is against the hidroviaria. So we know the problems. We know the environmental problems. We know the indigenous problems. We know the social problems. What we don't know, what nobody told us, is why do some people think it's a good idea? What are the benefits for the local business community, for the local economy, for jobs? We need somebody to tell us the other side.
And do you think it's a good idea?
Maybe.
You're not sure. You think maybe it's a good idea?
Maybe, yes.
You're not sure.
Not sure. Aí vamos pro português, né?
Okay.
Por que eu acho que pode ser uma boa ideia?
The reason I said only maybe it's a good idea is that I'm not sure. And one of the reasons I'm not sure is that the federal government didn't consult local people so far. They haven't consulted local people. They sent in some experts and researchers from outside to look at the situation, but they don't really know and they don't really understand our reality. Why do so many people think that hydroelectric projects are good for the Amazon? Most of those people are outside the Amazon, by the way. The argument is that the standards of education and healthcare here are not high, but they will improve if the hydroelectric dams come to this region. But basically, that's saying that the dams should make up for the failures of the government to do a proper job.
And sure, he says, the dams will bring opportunities for local businesses, but only in the first 2 or 3 years when they're being built. He actually thinks the grain terminals on the river in Itaituba are a better bet than dams. Anyway, he says, China is coming in with a clear strategy, looking after China's needs. So I ask if he thinks the Brazilian government looks after Brazil's needs in the same way. He smiles, a little ruefully.
No caso, eles têm uma estratégia clara. Nós não temos a estratégia clara. Eu não sei se existe essa união nesse sentido, política.
Yes, he says, Brazil has a strategy, but it's localized and temporary. And certain interests dominate at certain times. But China? China has a vision for 10 or 20 or 30 years. And when they come here, they know exactly what they want. Soy and beef, so they don't have to use scarce water at home to produce those. They want minerals, he says, and more.
Temos que dominar os continentes, vamos expandir nossas áreas de atuações. Aí sim.
I have another sort of China-related question. China has pursued a road of development that's very similar to what Western countries have, you know, traveled to become developed countries. Do you think that that's kind of the choice for Brazil? Or in like, you know, you develop, you have economic growth, you urbanize even in the Amazon. Or is this perhaps a moment to stop and think about what kind of future Brazil wants, how much economic growth you need? And is there even room to do that?
Não existe investimento forte.
He's saying basically, unfortunately not. And the reason is that, you know, when you look at how education is structured, when you look at where investments in doctorates and university scholarship is directed, it's all towards continuing the same line. And there are some alternatives, yes, but they're very small, very few. And so essentially it's all about continuing this same direction that people have gone on before. And even if you try and argue against it, there isn't really a willingness to step backwards or to step sideways and try to do something different.
And how do you feel about that?
Como poderia sentir? Eu tento fazer a minha parte.
Look, I try to do my part. You do what you can, you try to change things, but there's a point where you just have to follow the line and you can't do everything you want to do.
Later in Santarém, when John and I were having our beer, looking out on where the muddy Amazon and the blue Tapajós meet, we talked more about the standard global model of development and its effect on the planet. You know, your basic end-of-the-day have-a-beer-bar conversation among journalists. John wrote about all this in his book, When a Billion Chinese Jump. The title refers to a tale he used to hear as a boy, that if a billion Chinese jump all at one time, they could move the Earth off its axis. He'd lie awake at night, worrying that that might happen. And then, grown up and working as a correspondent in China, he saw that a billion-plus Chinese were moving the Earth, or at least changing its environment through their sprint to economic development. He wondered how long this approach could continue. He wondered how long global development of the old-school industrial development variety could continue. He wondered if, in the same way that people talk about reaching peak oil, we had reached peak man.
The idea of peak man, I suppose it's a Malthusian idea that eventually mankind's demand for resources from the natural world gets so intense and so great that the natural world cannot meet that demand, and so there's a famine or there's a war or there's some kind of disaster that cuts the population. That's been predicted again and again and again, particularly in the past 100 years, but even if you look back at ancient history, even the Romans worried about this and prove wrong time and time and time again. Man's capacity to find more resources for themselves has been remarkable. It's the history of human development. And you're going to see the population keep growing, certainly until 2050, barring some sort of calamity, and then it's going to start to go down. So I think we might start to see a deceleration of lots of things. But the question is, in this period of peak man, when there's more of us living longer, eating more, if we can get beyond that, I think the environmental pressures will be much less, and hopefully you can do it without some kind of calamity. But to do it without a calamity, I think we need to be much more intelligent. We much need to manage our resources much better. We need to distribute our resources much better. And when we think of growth, we need to think of growth that is not material growth,
but cultural growth, intellectual growth, not just increasing GDP, but improving quality of life. I believe material growth has become something negative, something dangerous, something unhealthy. It's growth that's creating obesity. It's growth that's creating diabetes. It's growth that's creating more pollution. It's growth that's creating climate change. There's all these negative things coming out of it. And I think there'll be many increasing numbers of people are realizing that actually just pure growth by itself is not a good thing.
So you were telling me on the road that you were interested in coming to Brazil from China because you were looking for a place that had perhaps a different kind of economic model, a sustainable economic model. What have you ended up finding?
I haven't found what I was looking for. I came to Brazil from China because I felt that the Chinese model, although it was producing incredible results in terms of GDP growth and average income rises, the costs were so immense, particularly in terms of the environment, polluted rivers, foul air, all the things that we know so much about now. And so this wasn't the way forward. And I came here because at the time, Brazil had a government that was socially progressive, it was democratic, and it appeared to be doing a lot to reduce deforestation, which was incredible at the beginning of the century. And then after the Workers' Party came in particular, the then Environment Minister, Marina Silva, introduced all these policies to use satellite monitoring technology, plus boots on the ground, plus very intelligent sort of financial penalties for people who are involved in clearing land. All of these things were having an effect and really slowing things down. And I thought, well, you know, maybe this is a country where they've got some of the best things in growth. And the economy at the time was also going gangbusters. I think at one point growth was similar to that of China. Maybe it was only 1 year rather than 30 years in a row. But it either overtook or was just about to overtake the UK as the world's, at the time, I think it was the fifth biggest economy in the world. So there were so many reasons why I thought maybe Brazil was able to do it differently. But almost as soon as I arrived, it became evident that things weren't going swimmingly at all. The economy went into recession, deforestation started to rise again, the Workers' Party allied itself to their agribusiness interests, and then you have all these corruption scandals, and now Brazil looks like the last country in the world that would be a model for anyone. So on the national level, I've been very disappointed. But you can still hear, as you could in China, you can still find individuals who give you hope, who are really looking to find these long-term solutions to produce a sort of a more sustainable world where we're not just looking at short-term economic interests, but long-term interests for future generations, and not just thinking about ourselves, but thinking more of society and thinking more about nature.
You said something interesting when we were walking around, that in some ways you're more optimistic about China finding its way to a more sustainable model because they have more motivation to do so.
Yes, and this was my hope in China too. You know, it's a cliche. Every crisis is an opportunity. It's the greatest cliche ever. It's not because it's an opportunity. It's because you don't have any choice. China is so messed up environmentally. You cannot pretend it's not happening. You just step outside your door on a moderately polluted day and it's very clear something terrible is going on. So China has the incentive to change. China cannot ignore the problems, although it's tried to do it for ages. They catch up with you. And so I think because of that, they are very much looking for another model. And because of that, they are investing more than anyone in wind, in solar, coal use has gone down for the last 2 years in China. Suddenly, partly as a result of Trump coming to power, China suddenly seems like the good guy in climate negotiations, who's trying to lead the world in a positive direction rather than back to the fossil fuel age. So things have turned around in that regard. And then with Brazil, one of the things I realized quite quickly after I came here, and it's not just Brazil, but it's Latin America as a whole, there is less pressure to change things because you don't feel the environmental problems so much here because there's less industry and, more importantly, there are a lot fewer people. The landmass of Latin America, it's not that different from China, but it has half the population of China, all of Latin America. So in a sense, one of the reasons why we are looking over spectacular views of vast forests and these two huge rivers where we can see, I can't even see a single boat. In China, there'd be dozens, most probably. It's because economic development hasn't moved as quickly. It's because the population pressures from way back haven't been as great. And in a sense, it's because Brazil is behind the curve in a way. But hopefully that will give it an opportunity. If people really start to think, and it's not just the old materialistic on the left, the Marxist mindset, on the right, the sort of capitalist extractive mindset. If they really want to think, they don't have to make the same mistakes. And they should look for their own way. And Brazil could become a leader, because Brazil can show it has a beautiful country. And one of the things I've realized here is just how valuable a beautiful environment is. When you have your biggest frustrations in Rio de Janeiro or here in the Amazon, and problems with bureaucracy or concerns about crime or terrible traffic causes, all those sorts of things, you just walk down the road, look up at the forest, look up at the blue sky, breathe the fairly fresh air, hear birdsong, see probably more species around you than you might see in a week in China. It helps you get over all those things. And it's why Rio has this special attraction. And I think we just don't value that enough. And in a sense, that's the key thing. We need to value that more. It's so valuable. I think anyone who's come from China, comes from China to here, can really understand what that value is.
And yet those who are coming from China here, a lot of people who are looking to use the resources here to literally to feed China and to feed Chinese demand. There's Chinese investment coming in. There are resources from Brazil going to China. As you've been watching that dynamic over these past 5 years, I mean, does it feel to you like Brazil's kind of getting pulled into China's orbit in a way that perhaps surpasses what had been expected?
With regard to trade and China coming into Brazil and increasingly being the buyer of primary goods, particularly iron and soy, I think it's a little bit sad for Brazil, because Brazil had been trying to industrialize and produce more value-added goods. But what's been apparent in particularly the last 10 years is that it's actually become more dependent rather than less dependent on primary commodities, which is a shame, because that means it's not getting the most out of the riches it has. I don't blame China, and I don't blame Brazil for looking to the Chinese market. I mean, how can you? As far as they're concerned, you know, Europe and the United States has been sucking out resources. Why shouldn't China do it? And actually, it's just, it's like having an extra customer to sell to. You get a better price. The trouble is, and this is not necessarily China's fault, is China's just so big and growing so fast that what it's doing is on a scale that has not been seen before.
So if you think China's got a better shot of finding a sustainable development model, one that isn't going to be so voracious in terms of eating up resources from places like Brazil and Africa, how does that happen?
Well, China, I mean, I think the Chinese state has a better shot than the Brazilian one, just because the Brazilian one is so badly organized. The politics are so corrupt, and it really is, you get elected so that you can enrich yourself. That seems to be what's been happening for many of the people in parliament. So it's very hard to think that the Brazilian government is going to come up with a good solution. I think there are lots of positives in Brazil that can be contributed to it, from exploring different cultures, different ways of looking at nature, from indigenous groups, from some of the many universities, some of which are extremely good, and people are looking at these issues. The agricultural sector, the research in the agricultural sector in Brazil is of a really high standard. And actually, Brazil is a very important player in climate change negotiations and has done a great job, I think, in trying to bring the developed world and the developing world closer together, and also the sort of Western culture and culture in other parts of the world, and the Southern Hemisphere and the Northern Hemisphere. They're just brilliant at that. If you can ally that some of those positives with some of the Chinese positives, which are when you make a change, you can do it at enormous scale. So, for example, making wind power much cheaper, making solar power much cheaper, and reducing coal use. All of those things set an incredible example and also offer opportunities for other countries. But ultimately, I think their solution has to be about values. And there you kind of get into really tricky territory, you know, valuing nature more. But I think that becomes a question of education. I think that becomes a question of culture. I think it becomes a question of religion and philosophy. And China has a very rich philosophical tradition. And if it looked back into the past, not just so much at Confucianism, but a bit more at Taoism, that would be positive, I think, in terms of trying to exist more harmoniously with nature, taking nature more into consideration.
So I've noticed on this trip that you've asked a lot of people, do you feel optimistic or pessimistic going forward? After this trip, do you feel more optimistic or more pessimistic about Brazil's future?
I'm totally miserable all the time and always have been. It's part of the job, right? I think part of journalism is we have to be professional worriers. It's like before you organize a party or organize any event, to make sure it goes right, you know, you have to go, that might go wrong, that might go wrong, that might go wrong, that might go wrong. And I think one of the things journalists do is kind of try to anticipate those things and point out those things. So it really helps if you're incredibly miserable like me.
So but you're not answering.
No, I don't know. I mean, I suppose I'm a... What's that expression William Golding used? I'm a...
Cautiously optimistic?
No, I'm a universal pessimist, but a cosmic optimist. So
I like that.
So I guess, you know, when I look at the short term, I think things are going to get very grim. In the long term, there's so many reasons why things could also be good. You know, there's so many incredibly talented people who care about this. Human beings have shown themselves capable of remarkable adaptation, extraordinary technological leaps. And nature, as you can see in the Amazon, is so vast and has been able to absorb our impacts. You know, there's a lot of wonderful stuff still out there. We've still got a lot to protect and look after and feel passionate about. And with regard to Brazil in particular, I'm pessimistic in the short and medium term. I think the Workers' Party had its flaws, proved very corrupt, but had tried to do something different and has made some gains in reducing extreme poverty, improving education opportunities in universities for black and mixed race students. It tried to change what Brazil was. The current government seems determined just to go back to the old way of there's a extremely powerful, pretty much white male elite that has the land and the capital, and they will...
That sounds vaguely familiar.
It's the story, right? It's the story all over the world. You know, it's in the US, you have a president recently elected who is basically serving the interests of old-fashioned extractive industries, working with foreign governments to push extractive industries with fewer regulations, fewer environmental controls, and quite happy to do deals with anyone in order to do that. And in a way, that's exactly what you have in Brazil. Right? I mean, Michel Temer is not Trump, fortunately for Brazil, but he represents a similar set of interests of people who want to exploit the Amazon and other parts of this enormous country with less oversight, less need to be worried about indigenous people, less concern for protected environmental areas. In a sense, this sort of clique who's had powers in the country for generations and generations are coming back. And if you want to be optimistic, you could say that for a long time they sort of operated in the shadows and being able to influence everything, but now maybe things really were changing in a way that threatened their interests. And maybe if you can get rid of Trump, if you can get rid of Temer, you've sort of overcome not the last resistance, but one of the last pieces of resistance, and maybe people will start to realize actually the way we're going is a lot better than going backwards to imaginary past, a dirty past, a polluted past, a more racist past, more violent past. That would be a reason for optimism. And so, you know, I see this moment, going back to this idea of peak man, I see the sort of the global economy hitting an ecological wall. You know, maybe it's not a hard crash, it's gradually careening towards that, everyone. But it means you can't keep growing the way you grew before, the rates you grew before, without paying as much attention to how you were growing. As this happens, and as it becomes harder to grow, maybe even start to get more and more recessions, more and more economic crises, more frequently, tension's going to grow, because it's harder for leaders to negotiate with the populations and also negotiate with other countries and say, oh, we have a win-win solution. You know, we're both going to do really well out of this. It's going to be more and more, no, actually, one of us is going to lose out of this, maybe more than the other. And so I think these things, which are all caused, I think, by ecological pressure, are pushing people towards feeling more stress and maybe not knowing quite why they feel more stress and more tension and more unhappiness. And also desire for people to have like strong leaders who are going to defend our interests, because cooperation, international cooperation, when there's a zero-sum game, especially if you're ahead, you want to protect what you have. So, you know, if we had start to look at those fundamental problems a bit more, then maybe we're more likely to find the solution than if we just see the problem as political or just see the problem as economic. We have to go deeper than that.
Toward the end of our Amazon journey, we met a local couple and walked with them along the banks of the river.
Super legal.
Wow, it's so clear.
Look at that. Look at that water. Muito claro, caramba.
The woman, Monica Almeida, worked in our hotel. Her husband, Chico Malta, is a popular local singer who often sings about the rivers and people and fantastical creatures of the Amazon. They say they used to live in Sao Paulo, Brazil's huge, sprawling business center with 12 million people, but they prefer the pace of life here. Still, as we walk, Chico laments how the river is changing.
Changed a lot, and one of the ways it changed was because of all the miners in Itaituba who are using mercury to get at the gold. And so there's a lot of contamination that came downstream, even as far as here. That was a big impact. And now all the riverine communities fear an even bigger impact from the dams and all the other big projects that they're doing up here.
Still, Monica says, being here sure beats being in Brazil's big cities these days.
So she says, I'm scared of going to Rio because, you know, I see on the television all the crimes and that, you know, people lose their lives just over a cell phone. So it's just some new gadget and yet people are dying for that.
Here, we walk past relaxed outdoor cafes where locals nurse beers while watching the river, past young couples and families out strolling on a balmy evening. Chico and Monica invite us to their home, just a couple of minutes' walk away, so we can hear some of his music. As we climb a path near their home, we see a somewhat disgruntled-looking gray cat sitting smack in the middle of our pathway. Turns out, it's not a stranger to our new friends.
She says, my grandchild. This cat is my grandchild. Alexander. Come home, Alexander. What are you doing?
It's their cat.
Moram in Paradiso.
How good is this? They have their own swing.
They have their own swing?
They have a swing in the porch.
Side beat, side. John sits down on the swing. Monica gets cold drinks. Their daughter, Faitosa, who's in law school, comes out to join us. And Chico gets out his guitar. He says he not only writes his own music, he writes poems and collects histories and dramas of the indigenous people of this region. His father was part Munduruku, one who went to live in the city, and his son, it turns out, did okay. But now he's back here, appreciating the land and lore of his ancestors, and hoping his music will help others connect with it, perhaps even enough to save it.
Que zomba com tudo, que zomba, mas não zomba de mim. Que zomba com tudo, que zomba, mas não zomba de mim.
This song is a protest. He sings, "Don't build dams on the Tapajós. Nature has given us energy from the wind and the sun. Nature in the Amazon is worth protecting." More than the profits from dams and farms and cattle and mines, Chico sees the Amazon as a treasure, as the real wealth of locals, of Brazilians, of people everywhere. And unlike corporate fortunes, which rise and fall and rise again, there's no replacing the Amazon once it's gone.
Ouça nossa voz, não queremos barreiras no Tapajós.
Huge thanks to my old friend and respected colleague John Watts for sharing his knowledge, contacts, and insights on Brazil, for organizing this trip, and for patiently translating for me while we were on it. Portuguese is at least the third language John has learned as an international correspondent, after Japanese and Mandarin. Respect. If you'd like to learn more about Brazil's economy, check out my earlier podcast episode, "Rebuilding Brazil's Economy Will Take More Than Bricks and China." That and all other print versions of previous episodes are archived at pri.org/century. The audio is available wherever you get your podcasts. Funding for this trip came from a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation, which helped give birth to this podcast 2 years ago as a co-production with PRI's The World. I'm now entering a new chapter, doing this podcast on my own, with a new website, whosecenturyisit.com, and a new Facebook page called Whose Century Is It? I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. You can send me a short message there, or a longer one, at whosecentury@gmail.com, or on Facebook. If you haven't already subscribed to this podcast, please do, on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, please rate it and leave a review. It helps others find it. Thanks for listening. Until next time.
Ouça nossa voz, não queremos barreiras no Tapajós. Não, não, Senhor, ouça nossa voz, não queremos barreira no Tapajós, não queremos barreira no Tapajós, não queremos barreira em rio algum. Zomba que zomba com tudo que zomba, mas não zomba de mim. Que zomba com tudo que zomba, mas não zomba de mim. Que zomba com tudo que zomba, mas não zomba de mim. Que zomba com tudo que zomba, mas não zomba de mim. Sou caboclo, não minto, posso não saber tudo, mas do meu pouco estudo, sei que norte é Brasil.